Welcome to Response Leadership, a podcast brought to you by the Texas A&M Engineering Extension Service, a leader in response training. We are a podcast bringing you leadership expertise from the top minds in emergency response. I'm your host, Craig Weaver. I work in communications at Teeks. And today, our guest is Graham Jones, the executive director for the 100 Club Central Texas. And also joining us today is Elisa McDonald. She's a program director for First Responders Wellness and Resiliency. She worked at DPS, licensed professional counselor. Thank you both for being here. Yeah. Let's start with this. Give me some background on who you are so people know who what you've done, and we'll get to the 100 Club.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me today and traveling to Austin as well. Really appreciate that, making it easy on everyone. But I worked with Texas Parks and Wildlife for about 27 years. I started off over in East Texas, and that's where I met Elisa, and I've known her for a long time, good friend. And kind of just, you know, worked through the ranks at Parks and Wildlife, and ultimately retired in 2020 as a director of law enforcement. And I always had something that really interested me along the way was, you know, again, was consistency, training, education. And I think that goes hand in hand, obviously, with Teeks, your program.
Okay. Yeah. How did you get to, what do you do now?
Well, I'm the executive director for the 100 Club of Central Texas. And we're an organization, nonprofit, that supports the families of first responders during critical incidents, including line of duty deaths or injury. So we either support the first responders when they're injured critically, or we support the families if there's, you know, been a death.
How did you get here? How did you become the?
Well, that's a great. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think it was just the culmination of a lot of doors opening, and I had an interest in the 100 Club growing up in Houston.
Okay.
The club in Houston is very well known. It goes back to the 1950s. Okay. And, you know, you're very aware of the club in Houston. I think you're more aware of the club.
It does have a pretty big presence.
Yeah.
I grew up seeing it, not knowing what it was, but it's undeniable.
Yeah. Exactly. And so when I transferred to Austin in the early 2000s, I volunteered for the club here and worked on the board and spent a lot of time volunteering for it, for the organization, for the 100 Club. And then when I retired from Parks and Wildlife in 2020, this job was open and it just seemed like a natural fit. I was going through a lot in 2020 also. And so it was a great way. I mean, it was just, again, you think about how by happenstance or for whatever, doors just sometimes open up, and this one did. And, it's just honor, absolute honor to be here and work for the 100 Club. It's where I need to be.
What would you say is the biggest challenge you face in your current position?
I think awareness is a huge issue for us, both looking at the public, as far as the public goes, and the public being aware of what the 100 Club is. And then also, as far as the first responder community goes, there's lots of first responders that have no idea what the 100 Club does. That's not their fault. That's our fault. That's, you know, that's something that just we've sometimes, you know, not gotten the message out as we should have. But, you know, I talked to William Skeen, who's the executive director down in Houston, and he said the same thing. But, you know, we'll have, say for an example, if there's a first responder that's been injured. And we're always very conscious of how we approach them. And what we do initially is just is financial support, right?
So, okay.
You know, however we deliver that check to that first responder, a lot of times they'll be like, well, I'm not a member. Aren't I supposed to be a member?
Right.
And it's like, no. It's not about you being a member. It's about us serving you. It's about the members serving you. And so just that awareness is a big, big challenge for us, and getting the word out. I think especially with this generation, both of residents of Central Texas and also with first responders, it's just, you know, it's a little different than I think it's been in years past as far as our marketing approach and how we sell the name of the organization.
How do you do that? That seems like a huge, first of all, it seemed strange, I guess, for me to hear that there are first responders that
yeah
that don't know.
Oh, sure,
but how
sure.
What do you do to get the word out in that community? How do you
you know we do a multifaceted approach.
Okay.
Social media.
Okay.
Conventional media. We have a great relationship with some of our media partners here in town that will when again it's not ever trying to sell our organization in the time of a tragedy. We're very conscious about that. But they do, I think, help to make the public aware of the 100 Club when there is a tragedy. Because, again, we're a membership-based organization. We can't do what we do without members, without financial support. And so, again, we utilize social media. We have events and fundraising throughout the year. We have an award ceremony, which is fantastic. I think it's a way to recognize the good work that first responders are doing. And I think it's a great way to showcase the great work, the heroism that these first responders, you know, that are doing every day, right?
Right.
And so that helps. And then we have scholarships too. And so we give scholarships. In fact, we just got a large donation from a donor from Jim Orr and Dee Dee Orr, who own GT Distributors. And they just gave us $125,000 that's going to be utilized specifically for first responder training.
Hmm.
Or scholarships, you know, continuing education.
Okay.
And so that's a big deal. Again, we can see how education and training is related to success and safety and just more professionalism and just it goes full circle.
Okay.
So my question would be, do you ever run into situations where people are requesting resources from 100 Club that you can't provide?
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that you know, our focus, the mission of the 100 Club, the bottom line, what we do every day is initially is that financial support. So when something happens, a tragedy occurs, a line of duty death or a critical injury, we try to get that financial support to that family or to that first responder a lot of times the same day, if not the next day.
Okay.
Now, again, as I said, we're very conscious of how that every situation is different. It's not about us, it's about them. So that's our primary focus. And of course, long term, we provide, I call it emotional support, but it's just maintaining a connection to that family on maybe Father's Day or Mother's Day or holidays. We touch base with the families, we'll send them a card, we'll send those kids a graduation check when they graduate from high school. We keep in touch with them. But with that being said, there's certainly times when we are asked, to support a situation that we can't, either because it's our bylaws or a financial restraint. Of course, if there's again, we're gonna achieve our mission, right? We're gonna take care of those line of duty deaths and those injuries. But we are receiving more inquiries related to really mental health related needs.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly since I've been here, just in the time that I've been here, I'm personally aware of more of those situations that have come up. And I think it is something that, you know, our board has discussed.
Okay.
I think it's obviously there's a lot of ways that someone can be injured. And I think that you know, normalizing that as we move forward and recognizing that as are other organizations and agencies beginning to as well, I think it certainly would be something that, you know, we're heading in the right direction in addressing.
Yeah. So a mental health disorder as an injury that occurred because of the job or even suicide as it relates to line of duty death.
Oh, I think that my personal belief is that certainly suicide, in many cases, suicide would qualify as a line of duty death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I know of examples where it has. I think that agencies and the public are starting to recognize that as well. Because I mean, again, it's a, you know, if you or I go to get a heart, you know, heart scan tomorrow, that's we consider that normal. Well, that's physical health, right? Mm-hmm. Physical health is important. But as I mentioned, there's a lot of ways to be injured. And I think normalizing just what we can do to normalize the need for mental health awareness and for mental health for help when someone needs it, I think we're also setting that person up to succeed long term.
Totally. Yeah.
And to just be a more healthy, all well-rounded, healthy individual.
Yeah. And it makes a difference for the first responder, but also their spouse, children, and all the things that follow.
Are you seeing the tide turn, for lack of a better way to say it, in terms of mental health coming out into the light? Like people are, is there a stigma attached to it? Do you still see that someone in that community?
There's certainly a stigma attached to it. I think there's less of a stigma than when I went to work. And I was going to talk about this at some point today, but we had talked earlier and we had briefly talked about mentors. And I mean, I have mentors. Yeah. I have, you know, I still have mentors. I mean, there's people that mentor me every day.
Right.
That I look up to of all ages. But there was one that I really go back to when I first started working was John Fuller, deputy sheriff. And we had responded together to several situations that were, that I would consider to be traumatic to some degree, difficult situations to deal with. One of them was a pretty serious traffic accident or a very serious traffic accident. And, I was young. I mean, I'd been working for less than a year. There was at that time with Parks and Wildlife, there was no FTO program. There certainly wasn't any counseling or anything like that.
Really, none at all.
No. Huh? Wow. And so he, you know, he wanted to talk to me about it. He knew kind of what I was going through because he had been there early on. And so, you know, he normalized that for me and helped me normalize that. Of course, when he asked me if I want to talk about it, I said no, because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. But
you're being tested.
Yeah. But over time I saw the value in that, and it certainly helped me. And I think just those simple being socialized early on as a first responder, not just in law enforcement, EMS, EMT, firefighters, dispatchers, the whole gamut. I think being socialized early to understand and just to make it normal.
Yeah.
Along with that, you know, other, you know, being healthy, exercise, you know, relationship health, all these things, I think they're all pieces of the puzzle.
I can imagine vulnerability is not something that's readily, I mean, it's good that you say that it's changing, it's changed, but I could see in the old days it wasn't.
Yeah. I think being vulnerable as a leader is maybe the most important.
Really?
Aspect you can, but and I think it also it makes the leader relatable, I think too.
Right.
And I'm saying leader, I'm not saying supervisor, because there's certainly a difference. I think to me, I see being vulnerable is the opposite of being arrogant.
Yeah,
you know, that's how I see
it.
And I think that I think we learn a lot from all types of supervisors. We learn from good ones, we learn from bad ones. I have learned from good and bad and tried to adapt to some of that. I think that to me, the leaders that I respected did make themselves vulnerable, and listening also is hugely important.
Sure.
But it's the ones that like accepted the blame and then gave credit to someone else. Those are the ones that I tried to emulate. For the most part.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you're talking about arrogance, and still, you know, if you're looking at it from my perspective as a mental health professional,
those are the
people that I like to have in counseling, because I'm like, that's just a defense mechanism. So let's peel the onion a little bit and find a new way. And so.
Sure.
You were saying earlier, you know, we talked before this and you had mentioned, the concept of having one's bucket full.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, someone early on mentioned the whole bucket concept to me, and it might have even been in a training scenario that it came up. But I kind of see it as we all have our personal buckets, right? And we have, you know, worry, what are we worried about? What keeps us up at night? Finances,
right.
Relationships, work stress, all these variables. And then you add on some of the things that first responders are dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and you could put in one traumatic event or multiple traumatic events, or, and just kind of over time, all these things add up and start filling that bucket up. Mm-hmm. And it's not, to me, it's not how do you empty the bucket? How do you keep the bucket empty? To me, it's right. just how do you keep it from overflowing? So it's like there has to be a drain on there at a level, right? That somehow keeps it from overflowing, because when it overflows, bad things happen.
Right.
From the least of which is being unprofessional. That's the least of which could happen, right? And so I think that whether it's maintaining just a healthy lifestyle, again, exercise, eating right, friends, friendships. And again, something that helped me my whole career was maintaining a group of friends outside of the first responder community. Okay. Within, certainly within, but also outside. Sure. And merging some of those relationships. So it's not just, you're not just going, as Joseph Wambaugh wrote about, you're not just going to choir practice after work with a bunch of other first right. responders, right?
Yeah.
Which I'm not minimizing the relationship with first responders. That's hugely important, but it's a piece of it. But having a confidant to talk about what you're going through. I mean, how many times have you heard someone say, well, I'm not going to bring my work home?
Right.
I mean, my brother-in-law is a doctor. I've heard him say, I'm not going to bring my work home. So it's not just first responders, but I certainly didn't bring my work home. I didn't talk about it. My wife would ask me, do you want to talk about it? I don't want to talk about it. You know, I don't want to bring you into this,
right.
to this world. And that's really probably not the best idea. So it's not that I've done everything right, because I certainly haven't, but it's how can you try to make things better, right?
Okay.
And if we can learn and maybe pass that along to others, I think we're doing the best we can. But part of that, keeping that bucket from overflowing, is the mental health awareness. Mm-hmm. And
sure.
And again, back to normalizing that. And I think through some of it, I think, is the responsibility of the agency through policies and procedures. To where there are certain switches that occur at certain times to where, okay, well, if XYZ happens, it's mandated. I don't know how you feel about that, Alisa, if that's the current way of thinking, or if a volunteer scenario is always better. I don't know that. But I just know that a lot of people, if it's optional, aren't going to do it.
Right.
Example would be a traumatic event involving, like, let's just say a shooting. Well, that's mandatory at Parks and Wildlife. Okay. And I'm proud to have been a piece of that. It wasn't my decision, but it was a piece of it. I was part of that discussion.
Yeah.
And so, again, it's not just those big. It can be over time. It can be smaller events that add up.
Sure.
And also what I've noticed is the time period can be different. It can
oh, okay.
for, let's just take post-traumatic stress, whatever we perceive that as being. And I know there's a clinical definition for it, but just what I've seen, I think that scenario A might affect one officer a certain way, or a firefighter, EMT, EMS, whatever. And it might affect another officer a different way. And there may be a delayed reaction.
Right.
I've seen that delayed reaction many, many times. And it's difficult for me to explain, because I'm not a professional in that,
right.
you know, in the mental health world. But I've certainly seen it. And when you can see it over time, and you can see it's just weighing so heavy on, and then how do you get that person the right. help that they need?
How do you get,
yeah.
how do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that there's an advantage of making that requirement for them to see
right.
somebody. However, you've got to be real careful about what you're mandating or making people do, especially
exactly.
in the law enforcement
sure.
world.
Right.
But I do think it does a couple of things. First of all, I think it demystifies what a counseling session is. You're not going to have to lay on your couch, lay on my couch, right. Let me shrink your head or whatever.
Right.
Kind of get to know each other. And I think sometimes it kind of demystifies what that whole process is like. Because I think people have a preconceived idea of what it's going to be. And so that's a good process of them actually having to see someone like me who specializes in first responder mental health. But I will say there's also a huge advantage in having specially trained peers who have walked the walk, have the lived experience, but they've done their own work, but they've also had an opportunity to get specialized training on how to best help a peer. And so I think that's a good middle ground for them to be able to do that. And those peers can also share their experience about having a relationship with a mental health professional and the advantages. And so I think that's a good piece too. So I don't know how I feel about, I would love to say yes, mandate them all to come I'm not sure that's super realistic, but I think, a good suggestion.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that team is fantastic. Having individuals trained within an agency, at Parks and Wildlife, we had the critical incident team, which was that team.
And
of course we leaned on DPS a lot as well with their counselors. We don't have certified counselors, but we have the team, and the team is well trained, and they, go around the state depending on the scenario situation to help their fellow officers, and then maybe they identify something that needs to go, up the ladder a little bit. But I think that's a fantastic idea, and we've certainly seen the advantages of that.
Okay.
Yeah, and at Teaks, we're developing an internal peer team that's not just law enforcement or fire heavy, but is a universal group that we're training internally, but at some point can be deployed. But what they're going to do is, if Parks and Wildlife had a critical incident where your team was deployed, we're going to be there to support your team. Mm-hmm. So I think what a lot of teams kind of mess up on is they forget to take care of the people who are taking care of people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that's something we're going to develop that we can probably utilize at some point.
Sure.
Because it's very easy for those critical incident teams or peer teams to get just really overwhelmed, and
their bucket gets full, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Our overflows.
What good are you for anybody else? Yeah, exactly. And I keep wanting to jump in and say, and I want both of y'all to say whatever you want about this. We talked before about how first responder trauma is different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting to me, but feel free. What do y'all? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think it has to do with cultural competence too.
Okay.
And so I think, counselors are always required to take a certain amount of continuing education on cultural competence. But unfortunately, we have all of these subcultures we have to consider too, which law enforcement, fire, first responders is its own subculture. Mm-hmm. And the thinkings are a little bit different. And you can have a counselor that's very well trained and well versed in trauma, and I put that in air quotes, and understanding of the fight, flight, freeze response and all of those things and the way neurobiology and the way the brain works. However, when it comes to first responders, their responses are different.
Hmm.
So as a firefighter, or as a police officer, if you freeze, you die.
Right.
That part of how you respond to things is kind of eliminated. So you're operating on reactionary 24/7. And so it takes a counselor who's been specifically, specially trained in first responder trauma to really be effective and understand that. And again, if I'm speaking to a police officer who believes that I don't understand the culture, it's going to be very hard for the two of us to have a therapeutic relationship. So it makes sense that we come with those tools in our tool bag, so to speak.
Specific tools.
Yeah. And I agree with everything that you said. And I think socially, by definition, first responders, first response, the first ones there, right?
Right.
So we think about, we're on family vacation and we're going to drive to Disneyland and traffic is backed up and all of a sudden we drive up on this, this wreck and the family, you're seeing it and everyone's rubbernecking and looking around and looking at it. And what goes through our minds is, gosh, we hope those people are okay. How terrible. Well, I mean, that's every day for the first responders, right?
Right.
And so the the first responders are the fixers, you know, the fixers, the ones you call when you need help, and the ones that are there to defuse the situation or put out the fire. And so when they can't, that's the burden. That's the burden. And so, well, what should I have done differently? What if I'd gotten there faster? And then you add on, okay, well, we all know that if there is a shooting or use of force, then, and again, I'm talking about, when I'm talking in these scenarios, I'm talking about situations that are certainly justified, right? Mm-hmm. But there's still going to be an investigation, as there should be. And so that's added stress as well. And so you have all of these stressors, these variables that add up to make it different, to make these stresses different than, and there's other lines of work that certainly have stress. I'm not taking that away from anyone, but this is intense, uh-huh. and it's real and it's reoccurring. So when the fixer can't fix it, that's something that you're again carrying around. So there's that piece of it. I think that's what makes it different in a lot of ways.
You know, the first responders and especially some of the older ones that have been, it's been ingrained. It's almost like muscle memory. This is how I'm responding to these things. Uh-huh. And then it kind of trickles over into their personal life. And this is how I'm responding to things. And they don't even have the realization that they're struggling. I think I shared with both of you on our interview or meeting that we had before about the retired fire chief that said, I've never had any issues. I don't know. I'm just more resilient than most. And then later in our conversation, he's talking about his fourth wife. Right. And so, you know, you kind of have to, and you know, he may not have realized, or it may be, I don't know, maybe it wasn't the job that was the reason that he had four wives or four marriages, but you know, I can assume that it played a role, and he had no awareness that was an issue.
Well, and I think that's a great point with the fixer thing too, right? With being the fixer. You have to be able to turn that off to some degree too. And you can't always do that because you want to fix everything. You want to fix stuff at home. You want to fix stuff with your friends.
Right.
And sometimes people want to work out their own problems. They don't want you jumping in there trying to fix everything all the time.
Yeah.
And I have personally struggled with that, you know, because you can't always fix stuff, and you shouldn't always, some situations just kind of have to work themselves out.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, at home or with friends or whatever. So that's another switch that you have to sometimes at least be able to adjust if you can't turn it off.
You had mentioned how important it is to be vulnerable. How important would you say it is to listen?
I mean, listening is huge.
Okay.
And I think that's really defines leadership to me.
Okay.
If you can't relate if you don't know the story, your people's story, or the folks that work with you, or your friends even. You can't relate. You have to take time to listen, and adjust that, right, depending on who you're around, right. and be self-aware enough to adjust that. I have a good friend that I consider a close friend. I mean, I text with him all the time. And have had some deep conversations with him, maybe a handful of times. But when I'm around him, I really just kind of want to listen to him because he's fascinating. It's a good friend of mine, Kevin Russell. It's not that I don't want to necessarily talk a whole lot. I'm just fascinated with what he has to say. So I'm listening. But I think the key is to listen to everyone.
Okay.
And even the agency, maybe the non-believers are the ones that haven't bought into to you being in a position that you are.
Right.
And I certainly dealt with that. I think everyone does. But you got to hear them out. You have to give them a voice too. You can't just shut them off. And you know, good, honest debate, critical thinking is that's paramount. And so, but it's different from being a cynic. You know, critical thinking does not equate to cynicism. If someone is being cynical and disrupting the flow of the agency and socializing new recruits in that cynical mindset, And a perfect example could be trying to normalize mental health counseling. Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't need that. You know, that's ridiculous. Stick with me. I'll show you how to get through that. We've all seen those scenarios. Right. Well, those folks that needs to be dealt with. Mm. But a lot of the ways that you could is hearing them out, is figuring out the why. Why do they think that? Give them an opportunity and listen to what they're saying. And you may not agree with it, and they may not agree with you, but I think it does create some mutual respect if you take time to listen to folks. And also listening to support staff, even. I mean, the person that's sweeping the floor and the lowest paid employee in the agency is giving them a voice and hearing them out. That's important too.
Well, and they may be able to give you more feedback than most.
I've learned so much from,
Well, and active listening skills it's the ability to be quiet and hear what people are saying, but also hear what they're not saying to you. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you know, people might give you code or, you know, different symbolic meaning of certain things. Yeah. And really you need to be able to really listen to what...
Decipher that.
Kind of what's going on, and kind of make some decisions on how you're going to assist based on that too. Mm. So there's going to be a lot of leaders, especially first responder leaders, who hear this, and it may be a new leader. And so are there any tidbits of lessons learned, the things you would have liked to have done differently during your leadership that you would like to kind of add there?
Yeah, I think that one of the most leaders have to be willing to, as I said, to have those debates and have those hard conversations and listen to feedback, even if it's not what they want to hear. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to build your team and create your team in the way that, you know, someone has hired you. You know, someone hired me as director of law enforcement at some point at Parks and Wildlife. Someone hired the awesome police chief or the Houston fire chief. And so they've been trusted and empowered to move that agency forward. And it may not always be easy to talk about, but you've got to not be afraid to build your team. And if at the end of the day, if there's someone that's in that, in a position of responsibility, senior staff level, that is not willing to get on board, then you've got to make that tough decision and have that conversation with them, either, you know, to lead, follow, or really get out of the way. And it sounds callous, but it is, I mean, it's the health of the agency is hinging on that, and it bleeds down and people are watching. And so you have to have that. You have to have that freedom, and but also not be afraid to have those hard discussions. The other thing I would say is just be open to other ideas and other suggestions, and do your best to explain the why. And when Darwin was writing The Survival of the Fittest, and he was creating his thesis, and he was thinking about all of that, agree or disagree with his perspective, it was fascinating, because what he did is he reviewed that in a way that was before he made his public address and his released his thesis. He went through it and picked out what he thought the critics would look at and maybe even the cynics, and how they would pick it apart. So in his mind, he pre-answered those questions. And so in a way, he explained that why proactively.
Right.
And I think that's too what we have to do. We have to explain the why, because we can't just make a sweeping agency-wide decision because I said so doesn't work anymore.
Right.
We have to explain that why. And in that is that vulnerability and that listening and these other aspects that we've talked about is all contained in that. And that explaining
and even humility. We make mistakes, even as a leader, being able to say, and as a parent too, you know, I probably could have done that differently. Right. And I agree that I've made a mistake. And so let me tell you what we're going to do to fix it. So.
Absolutely. And I think flexibility too. Mm-hmm. You're being flexible. And just because I make this, you know, let's make this decision that we're all going to wear this uniform. Right. This is the uniform. Well, okay, maybe a piece of it doesn't work. So let's be flexible enough to adjust it to maybe it's not 100% of what that initial decision was, but it turns out to be 75 or 70 or 80%. It's not a failure. You're just being flexible and you're adjusting and you're evolving. Yeah. I think that's the key, is to continue evolving.
Yeah. Well, what would you say is the most rewarding part of your job?
The most rewarding aspect of at Parks and Wildlife was being around the people that I consider to be, and when I say being around, I'm talking about DPS and the sheriff's deputies and everyone that we worked with, is from municipal law enforcement on up, was being around folks that really cared, and which I don't care, I'll argue this to the day I die, the far majority, talking about 95% plus, feel this way. And there's some that don't, and they have no business being first responders. Mm. I've been very vocal about that. But the far majority, 95% plus, are good, honest, hardworking people that are in it for the right reasons. Mm. And so being around them and their dedication and their level of service is still inspires me every day. At the 100 Club, again, it's an honor to serve families that have made extreme sacrifices. The first responder themselves and the family both have made these sacrifices. The friends have made these sacrifices as well, because either, again, as an injury or, God forbid, as a line of duty death, I mean, that's as heavy as it gets.
Right.
And so it's when you show up on that front porch and you knock on the door, or you're meeting at the funeral home or wherever it may be, and you're delivering that check, it's not about the money.
Right.
And the money helps. Right, because it helps with some immediate needs, right? Because there's going to be state and federal benefits that kick in down the road, but this is immediate because they may have to fly family in. Mm-hmm. They have bills that are coming due tomorrow, and so it helps. But it's just that support, just them knowing that there is an organization and a group of folks out there that care. And I always say this is on behalf of the members and the board and the volunteers of the 100 Club. It's not for me. That to me is being able to serve the first responder community and the families is by far the most rewarding aspect of my job, is just being there. And it comes in a lot of ways. I mean, I've mentioned Jim Orr's check. We've gotten some other large donations recently, Burnzot Capital and PLH and John Paul DeJoria, Gary Spellman. Well, we have donors that give a lot of money. We also get a check, a handwritten envelope with $2 in it.
Right.
You know,
that's important too.
It's hugely important. And it's like, what did that $2 mean to that person that sent that $2?
Grandma on a fixed income who just wants to give. And that's a lot for her.
And you can tell from the writing and the envelope and how it's done. Yeah. So, again, there's a lot of ways that it manifests, but just this being a part of this big picture of what we do is very, very rewarding. Selfishly, it's a way to stay, you know, engaged with the first responder community that's obviously very close to me as well. So,
yeah, and I'm glad to know that you guys have kind of a long-term response too, because I've worked with families who've lost people in the line of duty death, and I feel like there's a lot of attention
at first
initially, and then things everybody just goes away. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad that you guys do that too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on here.
Yeah, thank y'all for coming. This has been, it's been an honor and a privilege to be on the podcast, and I really appreciate everything Teeks does. And again, talk about mentors. I mean, NIMKID at A&M and TDM is certainly one of my mentors.
Thanks for listening to Response Leadership, brought to you by Texas A&M Engineering Extension Service. New episodes will be released on the fourth Tuesday of each month. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Or visit teeks.org/podcast.